Sure.
The whole purpose of Shipbreaker is really to give young people a chance to experience the society that we as adults are handing off to our children. We hand them off a society that has fewer resources, that has fewer options, and has more challenges than the one that we inherited from our parents. And that's a generational failure.
That's science fiction writer Paolo Bacigalupi. His latest novel for young adults, and even us grown-ups, is Shipbreaker. And April is Poetry Month.
As Wallace Stevens greatly remarked, poetry is one of the enlargements of life.
That's literary critic Harold Bloom. In honor of Poetry Month, we talked to him about his wonderful collection of last poems, Till I End My Song. He calls it a defense of poetry. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. Earth Day's coming up, and what shall we tell the children? Whether you've got young ones at home or, like me, grandkids who are already asking pointed questions about the state of nature, it's a dilemma. Do we tell the truth? Try to explain that the natural world we're passing on to them is in deep trouble? End on a note of hope, one we're reaching for ourselves? Or do we just change the subject? Science fiction writer Paolo Bacigalupi says we have to tell them the truth. It's the least us grown-ups owe them. Of course, he's writing for an older youth audience, the plus 12 crowd called young adults. Bacigalupi hopes not just to warn them, but also to inspire them with stories of kids who succeed against the odds. His latest book, Shipbreaker, tells the story of one such kid living in a post-apocalyptic world on the Gulf Coast. Fossil fuels are a thing of the past, and most people struggle to survive, while the tiny elite live in comfort with their high-tech, clean-tech marvels. His protagonist, Naylor, is small, the better to worm into the deepest bowels of wrecked oil tankers to pull out the valuable scrap. Naylor meets an upper-class girl after a superstorm wrecks the wind- and solar-powered ship she's traveling in. Together, they set out to save the world from a nefarious cabal. The plot is familiar, but the finely drawn world of the novel, set sometime within the next 100 years, makes the book a fascinating read. Paolo Bacigalupi, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Thanks.
Shipbreaker is a dystopian novel, I think I can say, that takes place in the not-too-distant future, and maybe you could enlighten us on when do you envision this time frame?
Honestly, when I write, I try to avoid actually putting a specific date on it. I'm always aware of George Orwell's 1984 being time-stamped with obsolescence, sort of, even as it becomes more relevant. And so I try to avoid putting dates on anything. I always sort of say this, you know, sort of there's a general sense that it's 100-something years forward. But you know, I never actually try to nail that down too closely, because I don't want people to be too distracted about the specific likelihood of this event by this time point, or that event by that time point. But so at some point in the future, it's a story where we've run out of cheap oil and easily available energy, and climate change has had huge impacts where the sea levels have risen and massive hurricanes are striking against the Gulf Coast. And it focuses on a couple of kids, or several kids, who work on a shipbreaking operation on the Gulf Coast, tearing apart the old oil tankers and freighters from what they call the accelerated age, which is our age. And they're tearing apart the last pieces of sort of the former industrial petroleum-based society that existed before, for all the resources that they can harvest out of it. So
this is a future that's coming on us a much, much more swiftly than many of us thought. And it's got tremendous verisimilitude. The Gulf Coast, as you say, is very polluted. And also the social structure seems to be one that we're morphing towards with acceleration. Talk a little bit about the kind of society that has inherited this new environment in the world.
Well, to be honest, I really based a lot of what I built into the book is harvested from present-day circumstances around the world. It focuses on a vast gap between rich and poor, where there's a group of people who are massively disenfranchised to a horrific extent and are starving, and that's those kids on the shipwrecking operations. And then there are people who are very wealthy and have a lot of political power, a lot of economic power, and they sit at the top of the food chain. And the gap between rich and poor is, we have that now. We just isolate ourselves from it. We don't smash up against that gap very often. Whether you're talking about, you know, a suburb in, say, Tennessee versus an inner city school in Nashville, those two worlds are right next to each other but don't interact necessarily. And in the same way, the United States doesn't have a whole lot of interaction with the poverty of Bangladesh. And even a closer and more interesting example to me is El Paso has a very different life than Ciudad Juarez right across the border in Mexico, essentially one giant megacity divided by a border and dividing two very, very different kinds of life.
Yeah, and in your book also, there's the same disjuncture between those on the bottom and those that are often just seen from a distant horizon.
Right. For the kids who are on the shipwrecking beaches, tearing apart all these old oil tankers and freighters, they can see another version of life out on the horizon of the Gulf. They can see these new high-technology clipper ships sailing past, and they can see a different kind of life that's out there, these people on these sailing vessels who live a cleaner, easier life than the one that they live, and it's just out of reach for them. And a lot of the story is about them trying to get out to that life.
Yeah. And now, tell us, why are these ships being broken apart?
Resources. It's actually directly based on what happens in the shipbreaking yards of Bangladesh and Chittagong. They're tearing the freighters apart for the iron, the steel, the copper, everything that can be recycled. And what you see today in present-day shipbreaking operations is that resource-poor places like Bangladesh can accept in essentially our deceased tankers, our deceased freighters, our deceased ocean liners, and they can tear those apart, and that actually contributes a significant amount of raw materials to their economy. And so what we think of as recycling, it really looks a lot more like mining. They mine these ships for resources and then turn that into value at the other end. And so I'm really interested in that idea that when resources are scarce, that a lot of the things that we in the industrial West sort of take for granted and throw away, that waste resource is actually of huge value. And so the assumption is that in the future, as resources become depleted, we're going to look again at our waste stream and think about those things in a different way and want to try to harvest the value out of them. Of course, tearing apart something like an oil tanker or ripping apart computers or whatever kind of recycling operation you talk about is a pretty dirty, dangerous, toxic process. And so the people who are going to do that are not going to be the people who benefit from it. And so you're going to put the poorest and the most disenfranchised people to work tearing apart all of our junk to get the resource out.
And the children, because they have to be small to get into the smallest spaces.
Right, yeah. In Shipbreaker, I talk a lot about these kids who work on something called the light crew, which is the kids who go in and they tear out all the small fittings, all the wiring, everything that can be ripped out before the heavy crews come in and start actually carving up the ship. And so the kids have to be small in order to fit into small spaces, to crawl through ducts, to do all of this different stuff. And when they get too big, then they get kicked off their job. And a few of them, you know, might have a hope of getting into the heavy crews later on, but a lot of them are simply discarded when they're no longer of use, when they get too big.
And you have now the title...
Because that's the kind of happy story I write.
the happy story. You know, when we were talking before we formally started this interview, you said this was your, I forget the term you used, but this was like your light book, your happy book.
Oh, yeah, no, this is my light and fluffy stuff, absolutely. Hmm. The other stuff that I write when I write for adults, actually, the stuff I write tends to be much, much more grim. And it's not so much that the setting is not grim. I tend to focus on these mangled futures. I tend to be interested in the idea of what happens after the prosperity ends. Once the party's over, what does the world look like? And that's sort of a common theme through a lot of what I work with. But with kids' books, when I'm writing for young people, I do feel a little more comfortable writing stories that at least have a positive through line in them. And so the story that Naylor follows, the kid on the shipbreaking crew who's trying to find his way into a better life, he's going to have a sense of possibility and hope as he sort of makes his way through his very brutal world that I don't normally allow for my adult characters in my adult novels, because honestly, I don't really feel like adults really deserve a sense of hope. I think they sort of deserve a slap in the face. Whereas kids, because they're still developing their futures and they're still making decisions about what kind of future they're going to build as they come of age, I'm more comfortable sort of identifying paths to success for them that I might not be comfortable identifying for adults, where I just sort of feel like adults need a smack.
So you want to slap the grown-ups upside the head here. And in this book, Shipbreaker, Paolo Bacigalupi, the grown-ups really have failed the children. I mean, even within this society, not to speak of in the actual real society in which we live. The
right.
grown-ups have failed the children. I mean, what's gone on? Why has this happened?
Okay, there's a bunch of things that were going on for me when I wrote this book, actually. And I originally started writing this book thinking that I wanted to write about certain sustainability questions, about certain environmental questions, things like that. What ended up happening as I was working through the book was that it ended up also focusing a lot about what's a family structure, what makes a family, and what kinds of support networks do we depend on outside of family, and how, and a lot of it has to do with trust relationships, and a lot of it has to do with how we define those trust relationships. And so there's a character in the book, Naylor's father, who is a terrible human being, both drug addicted and violent. And part of the story became a query about exactly how much do you owe your family, and what is the value of family ties exactly. That ends up connecting for me in a lot of other ways to questions about adults failing children, because in a lot of ways I actually feel like the whole purpose of Shipbreaker is really to give young people a chance to experience the society that we as adults are handing off to our children. We hand them off a society that has fewer resources, that has fewer options, and has more challenges than the one that we inherited from our parents. And that's a generational failure. And so I'm interested in that from a couple of different levels, both inside of the traditional family structure, like what is a generational failure, and then in this larger sense of like what do we as a society hand off to our children. And both of those things ended up being really interesting to me.
I asked Paolo Bacigalupi what kind of feedback he'd gotten from his readers about the world he portrays in his books.
I would say that there's a segment of my readers who seem to understand that the world is built to describe specific things and to cause a certain reflection back to our own world, to look around at ourselves in our own world and ask some questions. I'd say there's another segment of my readers who simply read it as thrill ride. And that's kind of interesting, too. It says a lot about us.
Say more about that.
I think that without being incredibly judgmental, I think that we're quite dedicated to keeping blinders on about the kind of world that we're building for the future. And we've created a society now which is entertainment and, what would you call it, there's a science fictional term, eyeball kick oriented, I guess. People are looking for the next thrill. They aren't necessarily looking for more thought. And so as long as it's thrilling, they like it. But that doesn't necessarily mean that they're thinking about it. And it's something that I sort of have wondered about, whether or not Shipbreaker in some ways misfires, if it's st- still too much fun for people to actually think, and I'm not sure. I'm not sure what the perfect balance of those things is. When I write adult fiction, I've had people sort of accuse me of essentially writing grimness for grimness's sake, that's all I'm about, which isn't really, and you don't want to be perceived that way. You want to be perceived as having something to say that's relevant, as opposed to simply being, I don't know, Chicken Little worrying about the sky falling. I don't know. There's a lot of stuff there that I'm still sort of parsing through as I sort of see how each story goes out into the world and then what kind of response comes back. But it does sort of concern me when somebody says, hey, that was really cool and fun. And you're thinking, yeah, so did you get anything more out of Shipbreaker other than that? Or was it just really cool and fun? And I don't know. I mean, and you know, for each reader, their mileage will vary as well. So,
what you're talking about is very similar in some ways to the debate that goes on within the community of those of us, I include myself, who write about sustainability and climate and the environment, and that is, do you bum people out by telling them exactly really what's going on?
Right, exactly.
Or do you kind of entice them in by giving them lollipop visions of, you know, the wonderful green future?
Right, exactly. And that question of carrot and stick, that question of, like, what if you bum people out so much that they don't care, or they stop listening, that they deliberately bring down the blinders? I think that there's, in some ways, I think that we have an illusion when we're talking about sustainability, that by keeping the conversation going, we're actually doing anything at all. You know, people are going to put down their blinders. They put down their blinders by saying, oh, I can passively be fine, it's all good, you know. Or they put down their blinders saying, I don't want to hear you, I don't like what you're saying. But the behavior set, the actual behavior outcome seems roughly similar. You don't actually have a shift in behavior that moves towards sustainability. You either have people feeling good about themselves and doing nothing, or they're annoyed at you, but they're still doing nothing. And either way, you know, we don't change. And so given a choice between those two things, I'd rather speak truth. And I'd rather speak truth unvarnished. And that's kind of where I'm starting to feel more and more, is that people don't like hearing truth spoken baldly. And then you have certain, it's interesting, as a writer, you have certain question marks in your mind about, you know, if you want to continue to pay the bills, how baldly do you speak truth? I'm not sure that it speaks well of us when we candy coat what's going on, and I'm not sure that it speaks well of our audiences that they have so little tolerance for actually engaging with almost anything that's really going on in the world around them. And I count myself among those people. I mean, there are certainly times where I see a headline and I think, okay, now that I know that piece about the meatpacking industry or whatever, I think I can stop right there at the headline. I don't need to read the entire story, you know. And so I understand the very human urge to flinch away from information that's unpalatable or might force me to reevaluate my world, you know, and I recognize that. I'm just not sure what the clever way to slide past that is. Shipbreaker was an attempt to do that in some ways, and in some ways I feel like it succeeded too well, that it was too much fun. And, you know, then you're also sort of inside of the head of the crazy writer obsessing about all these things that I really can't control anyway.
If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with sci-fi writer Paolo Bacigalupi about his terrific young adult novel, Shipbreaker. It's about a young man living in a world of rising seas and scarce resources who must test his mettle against those who would destroy him. You're also writing in this book, I mean, although it's a book that's great to read for anyone of any age, but you're writing for young people who might be more open to the reality. I mean, I think, you know, back when I was a young adult, as they call it, when I was an adolescent and I was reading books about the future, I mean, my hunger was for a new vision.
Right.
And it had tremendous impact. I mean, when I read The Left Hand of Darkness by Ursula Le Guin, it made me really think very deeply about gender. Mm-hmm. When I read Woman on the Edge of Time, I mean, my God, that book by Marge Piercy had a great impact on me throughout my life. I mean, even today, there are times that I think about that future. And I look at the future, I look at the world we're living now, and I'm wondering, will there be pockets where people can create a new vision, or are we just going to be the dystopian vision?
Right. And I that's interesting. I got like three thoughts on that, and now I'm going to forget them all. But the first thought was that there are really very interesting pockets all around us, and that those idea sparks seem like, if they're, you know, given enough oxygen and they're given enough support, that they really could spread. And one of the things that, you know, as a science fiction writer, you're always sort of looking around at these little pieces of data and trying to say, well, is this going to be the telling storyline? Is this piece of information about how we can harness wind power? Or is this piece of information about how we can make a better, essentially a better kitchen fire in India? Is there something here that's telling me important information about the future, and how do I evaluate it against, you know, ExxonMobil's latest profit report? And which of these storylines is actually dominant? And so there are some questions always going on about, like, do we understand the dominant storylines, the defining storylines, or do we not? Which is really fascinating to me. And that was actually something. So the reason originally why I decided to write young adult fiction was there is a certain, I have a certain obsession with a being of use to the world. You sort of want to have some reason to think that your existence actually is worthwhile. And I realized that when I was writing fiction for adults, that you could have adults who would nod their heads and agree with what you were writing and think that what you were writing was important, but they fundamentally would not change. And not through any core fault of their own, but just because they have mortgages and they have jobs and they have this much of an investment in existing infrastructure. So their life is fixed. And so, you know, the metaphor that I've used before is to think about adults as being essentially trains on train tracks. And they're already late. They've left the station, and they're rolling down the tracks. And it's very hard for an adult to get off those train tracks and, you know, sort of hump their way across the desert like a caterpillar to some other set of train tracks that goes in a better, more sustainable direction. It takes a lot of effort. And even if you're going towards a cliff, it still takes a lot of effort to get off those train tracks. Whereas when I think about young people, I think about them as being sort of trains that haven't left the station yet. They're still acquiring their skills. They're still acquiring their values. They're still acquiring their educations, making decisions about what kind of people they're going to be, what kinds of professions they're going to follow, and also, you know, what kind of infrastructure they're going to build around themselves. You know, where are they going to buy their house? Is it going to be one in the suburbs, or is it going to be one in the city? Is it going to be on a farm? Is it going to be, you know, they've got these decisions that they can make. And so it seems worthwhile to have a conversation with people who haven't, you know, already set their lives in stone. And that is something that's really positive to me and is really interesting to me about that moment when we're young and we actually also want to do things that matter, and we also do want to have a positive impact on our world, and we haven't sort of succumbed to inertia and cynicism and all these things that we think of as more sort of adult values of, well, we all know you can't change the world. There was a whole line inside of Shipbreaker that I was really interested in, which is talking about technologies that I think are interesting and trying to make those really cool. And one of those in particular was wind power. And I wanted to talk about wind in a way that made it seem interesting and fun and exciting and fabulous. And that was where the clipper ships that sort of succeed our petroleum economy came from. And those clipper ships, these beautiful sailing ships with high altitude parasails and hydrofoils, you know, they're very high tech, and, you know, they're sexy tech cool. And part of that was that I was thinking, science fiction is really interesting to me because science fiction has had a long tradition of inspiring engineers. You know, a science fiction writer writes about something that's interesting, and then engineers get interested enough in it that they say, hey, well, what if I wanted to build that for real? And you see that with, you know, NASA scientists who grew up reading about rocket ships and then went on to work on rocket ships. And you see that with things like the video game Second Life, which is based off of Neal Stephenson's metaverse in the novel Snow Crash. You know, the engineering types saw the idea and found it so fascinating that they wanted to replicate it in reality. And so there's a part of me that very much hopes that if you make a technology like wind, or I mean an energy source like wind, interesting enough, that you'll inspire a generation of people to think, hey, wouldn't it be cool if we had those? And to sort of push in that direction. And that for me is the you know, as close as I can come to a carrot idea. It's not that the thing exists now, but wouldn't it be cool if?
It's making the possible real in the imagination, which is,
right,
in fact, the way things happen.
Yes, and that's a really powerful concept, and it's really powerful, you know, that in fiction you can describe these things. You know, I think it's the moment where I have a friend who's a science journalist. She writes a lot about the environment. She can't write about what isn't there. And that's the thing that's so powerful about fiction, and specifically about science fiction, is that ability to write about what might be there.
And I'm talking with Paolo
Gattigalupi.
Paolo.
I know it's a terrible name.
No, it's a beautiful name. It's a beautiful name. Paolo Gattigalupi, about his terrific novel, Shipbreaker. So, and you're saying, you know, you're saying, well, in a way that this is light, but really the positive vision is as powerful an element to this story as the negative one.
Right.
Is what I'm hearing from you.
I wanted to have those balanced things. The idea of here's the world that we're handing off to our young people, which is broken, fundamentally broken. It's resource depleted and it's damaged and it's hard. But also, here's a window into something better. And that, you know, if you can sort of pass through the keyhole, there is something on the other side that's more worthwhile. And that is, you know, sustainable technologies. That is these beautiful clipper ships. It is that life on the ocean sailing. And, yeah, it's the contrast between those two things that I think, it certainly gives me the tingle every time I describe it, which is sort of interesting. I'm like, huh, there's something powerful in the description of that idea of passing through to a better world.
And yet a world in this book in which very few people have access to that technology.
Right.
So that brings up another question. You know, you wrote this book before the youth revolution in Egypt and Tunisia, and of course they're in a very troubled place because the old order has really not given up yet. But what lessons do you take, if any, from that, in the sense that these are very much fueled by a youth who want a different future?
You know, it's interesting. I think, I think that, you know, revolutions are traditionally started by the young. Mao Zedong didn't decide to become a revolutionary when he was 50. And so, you know, this process of overthrowing governments and creating major social change, it's a young person's pursuit. Honestly, the lesson that I really take from a lot of these is that I look at the governments that fell and the governments that haven't, and what I see is, those governments that are serious about maintaining power do a much better job of it. And you see it in Iran, you see it in Libya, and they make their citizens bleed for every step that they take. And it's interesting to see that because, you know, when you see the first couple of governments topple, you think, oh, this is something that's, it strikes me as less of the power of the youth and more the weakness of the state.
Right.
That's, you know, sort of my off the cuff sort of thinking about it, but it's just, it strikes me that, you know, that in places like Iran, where they actually have a solid, you know, control over their military and also a solid ideological base, competing youth ideological base, that there's a much stronger chance of pushing down sort of what then becomes a somewhat isolated minority of students in the larger nation, as opposed to someplace like Egypt, where there wasn't a strong control over the ideology of the state, and so it failed, and so the state failed.
Paolo Gattigalupi thinks technological change alone can't solve our environmental problems.
I honestly think that we can't techno-fix ourselves out of our sustainability questions. I think that you either have to rejigger the way that we structure our economies and the way that we think about money and capital and value. And so there's a huge social change there where we sort of came to this point where we said capitalism triumphant and free markets triumphant. And this is the lesson that we bring from the defeat of the Soviet Union. And it's, I think that you're talking about really needing to rejigger the way that we structure our economies so that we don't perceive our natural capital as being an income stream. I've become really obsessed with economics lately. Both of the stories that I'm working on right now have a lot to do with economics. And I think that if you don't have that social hack that either reins in the power of corporate ownership or reins in the ability or the illusion that we can grow indefinitely, that reins in the idea that profit is an always escalating thing, and that it's an abstraction, that profit is abstracted from the natural resources that actually create that profit, I think that we're in somewhat in trouble. I mean, the off-the-cuff sort of example of that is something like Apple Computer, which is doing really, really well right now, but they have a massive incentive to sell more and more iPads. That's what they have to do in order to be a viable company. And as long as their profit incentive focuses solely on the process of extracting more resources and selling and then reselling to consumers, you're looking at a society that isn't working, even as it's fabulously designed.
Say a little bit more about that process of how writing science fiction, writing about the future, draws upon the world around you. And so what are you doing? What are you working on that does that?
I'm actually working on three different books right now, of all things, because, you know, why just do one? And a lot of what I do is I tend to read a lot of newspapers, and I read a lot of magazine articles, and talk to a bunch of friends about different things. And then I start asking these questions about what happens if this goes on? What happens if this is the dominant storyline? When I was looking at Shipbreaker, I saw the shipbreaking yards in Chittagong, and I thought, what if this is the future? What if this isn't just the isolated thing, but this is the dominant storyline? All of us mining our waste products for resources. What does that look like? And so you go around looking at those kinds of points of, sort of the intrusions that are interesting enough that you want to pick them up and look at them some more. So one of the ones that I'm looking at right now is essentially I'm fascinated by the tragedy of the commons, which is sort of the defining quality of, externalities, economic externalities, those things which aren't included in your basic price when you buy a MacBook Pro or whatever, and the tragedy of the commons, what happens with those resources like, clean air or clean oceans or the atmosphere generally when we're talking about global warming. And when nobody owns those things, but they need to be protected anyway, and where each individual gains a huge benefit from polluting but doesn't have any cost associated with it necessarily. And so I'm interested in those things, and so I'm trying to find a way to write about the tragedy of the commons and about externalities in a way that doesn't sound like a whole bunch of econ speak, but also sort of dives closer to talking about things like global warming without ever pushing the button global warming and without ever saying those words. And so that's one of the projects I'm really interested in right now is to sort of talk about environmental distress without pushing any of the hot buttons that have become so politically sort of charged lately, either with denialism or corporate obfuscation or, things like that, and to try to sort of wind past that for the moment and sort of just talk about pure economic concepts in a way that doesn't also seem to be talking about pure economic concepts. And so that's one of the things. And then the other one actually is connected directly to politics. And the next young adult novel I'm working on is a follow-up to Shipbreaker. And it takes place in a different part of the country. It's called The Drowned Cities. And it's actually all about politics. And it's actually, it focuses on a bunch of kids who are caught up in a long-standing war, and they've become child warriors, and they've been sort of swallowed up in a larger set of ideological battles. And the story is really about looking at our current sort of state of political impasse and then seeing what that looks like as it devolves. And so I'm really interested in the way that Democrats and Republicans talk about each other, the way they interact politically, things like that, and then where does that go over the long term? What's the end state of the kind of political no-holds-barred warfare that we've got right now, where it's very easy to call the person across the aisle a traitor? You know, what is the if we keep extrapolating these sorts of behaviors outward, where do we end up? And what kind of world, again, do we hand off to our kids?
Oh, well, those sound terrific. Well, Paolo Bacigalupi, your latest book is Shipbreaker. Thanks so much for talking with us here on Writers' Voices. It has been a fascinating discussion.
Oh, this has been fun. Thanks very much.
As we heard, Bacigalupi took inspiration for Shipbreaker from the shipbreakers of Bangladesh. Go to writersvoice.net to see a video of real-world shipbreakers and the hazards they face. And hey, listeners, did you know you can get Writer's Voice delivered right to your inbox? Just go to writersvoice.net to sign up. You'll get a weekly notice with an audio link you can click on to hear the show. And stay tuned now for poetry and more coming up right after the break. Don't go away. Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. In a later segment, we'll hear Harold Bloom talking about and reciting some last poems from his book, Till I End My Song. But next up, we talk with someone who has, like our previous guest, Paolo Bacigalupi, been thinking about the commons. It's David Bollier, who we've heard on this show talking about the intellectual commons and his book, Brand Name Bullies, and who I also interviewed about his book on the digital commons, Viral Spiral. Bollier's now looking into the idea of the ecological commons. What kinds of laws could be developed to protect it? I spoke with Bollier for another radio program I produced. Here's an excerpt from that interview.
The commons is both an ancient concept as well as a very contemporary one that's seen a lot of resurgence. It's ancient in the sense that human beings have always shared things in commons, managed things collectively. Some say that the species has evolved because it learned how to do things collectively, like develop language and other tools. But in medieval times, people shared land, forest, fisheries, timber, wild game. And they developed rules for managing that sustainably. There was not a tragedy of the commons the way Garrett Hardin, an ecologist, said in 1968 in a very famous essay. But in fact, people are able to develop rules and boundaries and sanctions and other systems for sustainably managing collectively certain natural resources. And Eleanor Ostrom recently won the Nobel Prize in economics for documenting and analyzing the various ways in which we can sustainably manage commons. So the challenge nowadays, however, is to develop laws and other systems that can enable us to do that today. Unfortunately, the law often is geared towards the economy that emerged in the 17th or 18th century when land was plentiful, we thought that nature was indestructible, and the chief problem was mobilizing capital to develop things. Now we don't have that problem at all. The problem is capital has run amok and wants to monetize everything in sight. So the question is, how do we protect the commons today? And I think this is a buried tradition that we're starting to recover. Many states in the United States formed themselves as commonwealths, the Commonwealth of Massachusetts. Pennsylvania and Kentucky are both formally commonwealths. And the idea was that there's certain shared common wealth that has to be protected as such. It's not something that is amenable to individual control, or its value is lost. So we need systems and institutions and laws and social practices that allow us to manage things collectively. And that is really the great cultural challenge facing us in the years ahead. How do we develop these new things? It's a massive creative enterprise, but I think a very necessary one for us to address.
You also are beginning to explore the idea of an ecological commons. What is that?
Well, historically, going back to Roman times and the Magna Carta, there's been a recognized ecological commons that there's certain aspects of nature that we're all entitled to and that cannot be privatized. So wildlife, for example, can't be owned. Water and air belong to us all. The Romans even had formal legal categories. Res commune was the word, the Latin word they used to describe it. The Magna Carta, too, and the Charter of the Forest, which was a companion document that is not very well known, explicitly recognized certain rights of commoners to use aspects. There's a lot of antiquated terms, but, for example, the widow's right of estovers, which is the right to collect the wood that fell down for her fireplace and so forth. So there were all these very specific and detailed rights that commoners had. We want to try to recover and reinterpret this law for contemporary times to assert what sorts of entitlements we as commoners have to certain natural resources. So, for example, why should companies that pollute have a right to pollute into the sky for free? After all, don't we all own the sky in a certain moral sense? Why should somebody be able to use it as a free waste dump? Yet the law doesn't really take account of this and recognize our formal rights as commoners. So part of this is about recovering old traditions and yoking it to new creative legal assertions of commoners' rights. So I'm involved with a number of people trying to develop this concept in a rigorous legal way. And I might add that no law goes by itself. It needs social practices. It's often called commoning as a verb. The commons is not just a noun or a physical thing. It's the social practices and relationships and values that allow us to collectively share it. So at least as much of a challenge as recovering or reinventing the ecological commons as law is reinventing it as a verb, commoning.
David Bollier. Go to writersvoice.net for links to more on the commons. Well, listeners, it's finally arrived. April is Poetry Month. I visited literary critic and octogenarian Harold Bloom in his New Haven home a few months ago to record this interview about his latest book, Till I End My Song. It's a marvelous collection of poems and his commentary, drawing on the work of poets he holds dear, from Shakespeare and Michael Drayton to Hart Crane and Aga Shahid Ali. All the poems are what Bloom calls last poems, written in the face of our inevitable mortality.
By last poems, I sometimes mean in this volume, perhaps more often than not, the very last poem that they wrote, like Michael Drayton's beautiful poem to the lady he had loved, but only in a companionate or friendly fashion all his life. In his last poem, the poem written the night before he dies, or a poem that seems to operate like a last poem. The Tempest is not Shakespeare's last play, but Prospero's extraordinary climactic speech. Pragmatically, is something close to Shakespeare's last poem. Or finally, a poem that a particular poet saw as the climax or fulfillment of their poetic career in relation to the inevitability of an impending death. So those are three different senses, but they are related. A literal last poem intended as a last poem, I would take, as I've mentioned already, Michael Drayton, a good friend of Shakespeare, the lovely poem beginning so well, I love thee. I write a brief commentary to introduce each of these poems. And he himself writes, I won't read the whole poem because it is 21 lines. And he writes, so these verses were made by Michael Drayton Esquire, poet laureate, the night before he died. And it opens beautifully. It's addressed to this lady he had been brought up with, Anne Goodair, Lady Rainsford. He had been a page in the service of Sir Henry Goodair, a friend of Sir Philip Sidney. Goodair's daughter Anne and Drayton, as I write, were childhood friends, but their mutual love was socially impossible, since he was a commoner and she was a high noblewoman, and they sanely settled for a perpetual friendship. And he commemorates that, since she's going to survive him, and he's very ill and he knows he's dying, and so beautifully written, so well I love thee, as without thee I love nothing. If I might choose, I'd rather die than be one day debarred thy company. Since beasts and plants do grow and live and move, beasts are those men that such a life approve. He only lives that deadly is in love, meaning that is certainly and fully in love. And then he ends the poem very beautifully. So all my thoughts are pieces but of you, which put together makes a glass so true, as I therein no other's face but yours can view. I found that quite exquisite and a beautiful tribute to the lady and a wonderful dying word on his part. Then I thought, since there are 56 poets, more or less, of the modern period from Thomas Hardy to the present, of them, about 25 were people I knew personally, 7 or 8 of them very close friends indeed. One of them was certainly a wonderful poet and wonderful human being, wonderful novelist also, Robert Penn Warren. And I want to find his poem. Here it is, Heart of Autumn. Warren was 25 years older than I was, but we became close friends from January 1973 until his death 16 years later in 1989. And he wrote this extraordinary poem, Heart of Autumn, which I always thought was the culmination of his work. I once told him that if I had to choose a single poem by him as his last poem, in the sense that it speaks his total word with permanent distinction, I would choose Heart of Autumn. And I say here, I think Red Warren would have wished me to do so. Rather reluctantly, Red told me once that the poem might have been his best. And it's an extraordinary poem. I can't bear not to read all of it or chant all of it. By the way, let's see. Red, I think, must have been in his 70s, when he wrote this poem. Heart of Autumn. Wind finds the northwest gap. Fall comes. Today, under gray cloud scud and over gray, wind flicker a forest in perfect formation. Wild geese head for a land of warm water. The boom, the lead pellet. Some crumple in air, fall. Some stagger, recover control. Then take the last glide for a far glint of water. None know what has happened. Now today, watching how tirelessly V upon V arrows the season's logic, do I know my own story? At least they know when the hour comes for the great wing beat. Sky strider, star strider, they rise, and the imperial utterance which cries out for distance quivers in the wheeling sky. That much they know, and in their nature know the path of pathlessness, with all the joy of destiny fulfilling its own name. I have known time and distance, but not why I am here. Path of logic, path of folly, all the same. And I stand my face lifted now skyward, hearing the high beats, my arms outstretched in the tingling process of transformation, and soon tough legs with folded feet trail in the sounding vacuum of passage, and my heart is impacted with a fierce impulse to unwordable utterance toward sunset at a great height. I find that marvelous. I find that Red Warren really assimilating himself to those wild geese and to their flight, which becomes an image of both the limitations and the strength of his own poetic imagination. And then, within the third sense, the sense of a last poem, really as a way of coming to terms with all of life, and a very close friend, A.R. Ammons, Archie Ammons, who died in 2001 when he was 75, remarkable poet. He wrote a poem in 1996, 5 years before his death. And it seems to me truly his last poem, as I say here, because it's miraculous in its control of a universal poignance. I won't read all of it aloud, but I want to read the very opening and the close. It's called In View of the Fact. The people of my time are passing away. My wife is baking for a funeral, a 60-year-old who died suddenly, when the phone rings, and it's Ruth we care so much about in intensive care. It was once weddings that came so thick and fast, and then first babies, such a hullabaloo. Now it's this, that, and the other, and somebody else gone or on the brink. Well, we never thought we would live forever, although we did. And now it looks like we won't. And then he goes on talking about how these things work out for us. And he suddenly says very powerfully, at the same time we are getting used to so many leaving, we are hanging on with a grip to the ones left. We are not giving up on the congestive heart failures or brain tumors, on the nice old men left in empty houses, or on the widows who decide to travel a lot. We think the sun may shine someday when we'll drink wine together and think of what used to be. Until we die, we will remember every single thing, recall every word, love every loss. Then we will, as we must, leave it to others to love, love that can grow brighter and deeper to the very end, gaining strength and getting more precious all the way. I find that, of course, almost unbearably moving, because I have been missing him now for 9 years. But, you know, I'm making this anthology sound too somber, and I don't think it is somber. I think it is affirmative. I think, as Wallace Stevens greatly remarked, poetry is one of the enlargements of life.
That was Harold Bloom, one of the last of the great literary critics of the 20th century. His wonderful collection of last poems is Till I End My Song. We started our show today talking with Paolo Bacigalupi about his young adult novel set in a dystopian world racked by climate chaos and the struggle over depleted resources. Here are two poems to young people, one describing the fears they have and the second describing our hopes for them. They appear in the anthology Poetry Speaks Who I Am, out from Passion Books and published in 2010. From the CD that comes with the book, first, we have Toy Derricotte's poem, Fears of the Eighth Grade.
Fears of the Eighth Grade
by Toy Derricotte. When I ask what things they fear, their arms raise like soldiers volunteering for battle. Fear of going into a dark room, my murderer is waiting. Fear of taking a shower, someone will stab me. Fear of being kidnapped, raped, fear of dying in war. When I ask how many fear this, all the children raise their hands. I think of this little box of consecrated land, the bomb somewhere else, the dead children in their mother's arms, women crying at the gates of the bamboo palace. How thin the veneer! The paper towels, napkins, toilet paper, everything burned up in a day. These children see the city after Armageddon. The demons stand visible in the air, between their friends talking.
Toy Derricotte reading her poem, Fears of the Eighth Grade. And now, one of my favorite poets, Richard Wilbur, reading his poem about his daughter, The Writer.
The Writer. In her room at the prow of the house, where light breaks and the windows are tossed with linden, my daughter is writing a story. I pause in the stairwell, hearing from her shut door a commotion of typewriter keys like a chain hauled over a gunwale. Young as she is, the stuff of her life is a great cargo, and some of it heavy. I wish her a lucky passage. But now it is she who pauses, as if to reject my thought and its easy figure. A stillness greatens, in which the whole house seems to be thinking. And then she is at it again with a bunched clamor of strokes, and again is silent. I remember the dazed starling, which was trapped in that very room 2 years ago, how we stole in, lifted a sash, and retreated, not to affright it, and how for a helpless hour, through the crack of the door, we watched the sleek, wild, dark, and iridescent creature batter against the brilliance, drop like a glove to the hard floor or the desk top, and wait then, humped and bloody, for the wits to try it again, and how our spirits rose when, suddenly sure, it lifted off from a chair back, beating a smooth course for the right window and clearing the sill of the world. It is always a matter, my darling, of life or death, as I had forgotten. I wish what I wished you before, but harder.
Richard Wilbur. His poem, The Writer, appears in the anthology Poetry Speaks Who I Am, out from Passion Books. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Go to writersvoice.net to listen to or download past shows, plus find out more about our guests and see videos or read book excerpts. You can also sign up to get the show delivered straight to your inbox or subscribe to the podcast. And follow us on Twitter at Writer's Voice. All one word. Thanks for listening. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.